Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us today is Heather Connolly, Senior Vice President for Europe, Eurasia, and the Arctic, as well as the Director of the Europe Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She served in the George W. Bush administration as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs. Heather, it's always a pleasure having you on. Thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Bell, Beretta USA, and Leonardo DRS all sponsored our coverage of AUSA Now, the Association of the United States Army's annual meeting this year conducted virtually. And before we start our conversation, as we go to press, NBC News is reporting that Defense Secretary Mark Esper is preparing his letter of resignation. That's all we know. At this time, we're going to discuss it more in full if there's a development on our roundtable tomorrow. Heather, the presidential race remains uncertain. The outcome of it remains uncertain. And that reality has prompted some soul searching, not just in Washington, but elsewhere in the world. There was this sense that Joe Biden would prevail handily. To underscore opposition to President Trump, his policies, and certainly his rhetoric. But the margin isn't that large, and Republican support for the president actually went up, both in terms of volume, but also in percentage of Republicans who came out to support the president. And that has engendered some concern on the part of some of our allies that after 4 years of this, after coronavirus and the response, or perhaps lack of response, the posture and attitude toward allies and partners, toward international organizations, that we sort of find ourselves where we are, is fueling a little bit of concern. How are allies interpreting where we are right now and what's going through their mind? Because there is this sense that even if Joe Biden prevails, we are not going back to whatever we thought was normal. Whatever comes will be different than where we've been perhaps even for many decades.
Well, thanks, Vago. I mean, you're absolutely right. I think it's really important for our listeners to understand, and particularly, obviously, I'm going to speak in the European context. You know, Europeans follow American politics almost obsessively. It's something that it just excites them. They get into it. That's why we have so much coverage of it. So you find there is great knowledge, but it's knowledge based on headlines, and it's incomplete knowledge about the complexities of our system. I mean, in many ways, I wish the American people were as in tuned and knowledgeable as some of our European colleagues. So this has extraordinary focus and attention because there's an enormous amount that's at stake. Our allies were as surprised as many were when President Trump was elected in 2016. And sometimes, in some ways, they've taken sort of the journey with us through this process. And their calculation was, as they looked towards the 2020 presidential election, it all was about, if this is a four-year, I'll put words in their mouth, anomaly of a U.S. president that has an adversarial approach to allies and an allied approach to adversaries. Okay, 4 years we can manage through, although they would argue, you know, hedging has already begun. 8 years is a different proposition. So there was enormous focus on this election. And, you know, in some ways, again, I think the parallels to European reaction to what I would say many in the, you know, the Washington establishment genre, for lack of a better word, you know, we thought there would be a repudiation of this worldview and approach. And there wasn't a repudiation. What we demonstrated in the election, count still going on, that we are deeply divided, and there wasn't a wholesale repudiation of this approach. So we too are trying to understand that, as are our allies. I think you're seeing in the allied response, again, particularly to Europe, you're seeing a variety of responses. So For instance, you have NATO member Slovenia. The Slovenian prime minister was the first to congratulate President Trump that he won the election right after the president had irresponsibly said that he had won an election night. And that's one approach. Prime Minister Viktor Orban has also sort of tweeted the congratulations towards the Republican Party for their increase in vote. And so you see where countries that have aligned very closely with President Trump in the White House are signaling that. You have the United Kingdom that's trying to walk this very fine line. They've had a lot of support from President Trump on Brexit. They need that free trade agreement to be negotiated and get through Congress. And they don't know quite how to manage this if Vice President Biden wins. And then you have Russia, where you have pro-Kremlin politicians saying that, you know, get your popcorn bowl and get ready to watch America rip itself apart. So again, you have this variety of responses coming from allies and adversaries, and they are watching this so closely. So it really does matter.
No surprise that the Slovenian leadership, given Melania Trump is a Slovenian American, would certainly be tweeting that. And I think that there is, you know, it's interesting when you mention sort of irresponsible statements. European election observers are pushing back against President Trump's rhetoric and constant efforts to sort of stop the count or undermine the election electoral process, even though it was underway, trying to get votes stopped, for example, on election eve before absentee ballots were fully counted. Obviously, that's the process that we're in.
Well, I'm just on that, just if I can pause you for a second. It's really important. I'm glad you noted the role of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the OSCE. Why does the U.S. invite international election observers to the United States? Well, the United States deploys numerous Americans to observe others' elections. This is how we do it. We embody the principles and we put into practice the principles. So it was really important for OSCE monitors to have a look at our election, right, as Americans go look at other countries' electoral processes as well.
Even if they find, and many Americans find, the Electoral College something utterly baffling, right? I mean, every other nation, you just win more votes, that's the end of it, and you win. In our case, you could win a lot more votes and still manage to lose the election, as has been the case in several presidential elections. God, I'm going to look forward to the day when I don't have to explain all of this to another
It's complicated. It's
foreign
complicated.
Friend of mine. But where do we go next, right? So even if it's Joe Biden is seen as potentially a respite, that the Republican Party now is a full reflection of President Trump, and that whoever is to succeed, whether it's a Mike Pompeo or a Nikki Haley or anybody else, is more likely than not to reflect President Trump's strategic vector, even if they do it in a more concerted way with perhaps slightly less incendiary rhetoric. Although I have to say, the incendiary rhetoric and the disinformation and anything else doesn't seem to have hurt the president at all, nor does it appear to have hurt Republicans at all, right? I mean, so if it doesn't hurt you, you have a tendency of wanting to do it again, especially if it advantages you. Where does this debate go next?
Well,
right,
I think
where does the relationship go next?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. That's a great question. I don't have any insightful answers for you. I think it's a question for me of, you know, who will lead this party in the future if President Trump is not reelected. Will it sort of the pendulum swing back a little bit to, you know, the internationalists who, again, sort of much more of the Reagan mantra? I mean, I know the president has used the peace through strength mantra so much, but that strength was because the United States had allies, and Ronald Reagan certainly knew how to, you know, we had difficult moments with our German colleagues during the Reagan administration, for sure, on INF and a whole other range of issues, but that was our strength. President Trump views allies as our weakness, as a drain on American strength. So it will be interesting to see who carries that mantra forward and whether they have a more traditional view of this, or you're absolutely right, that now the Republican Party, you know, boos when a president says the word Germany. That's what we don't know. And I think that really is a question mark of how much President Trump does truly remain the leader of this party, even if he does not win re-election. But the challenge here, Vago, I think, and this is sort of the challenge we've been in for quite a while, and it's just been very acute right now. We, for the last 25, 30 years, swing so wildly right now in foreign security policy between the Republican and the Democratic Party. We've lost bipartisanship around big, important issues. And in some ways, President Trump just really sort of blew it up properly, but it hadn't been going well. You can't, you know, join the Kyoto Climate Accord and then the next president pull back. And that was the same thing. We join Paris and then we remove ourselves. You can't have that pendulum swing and have allies support your policies and your objectives and your interests over the long term. They don't trust that we'll stick to something longer than 4 years. And that's justifiable in our behavior, whether that's we sign on to the Iran nuclear deal, we don't have bipartisanship around that, we remove ourselves from it. So we, the United States, has to balance ourselves on key issues. And I would argue getting a better long-term view on the value of allies has to be essential to it. We have to learn, and I hope we don't have to do it in the painful way, why it is America's great advantage that we have allies. China and Russia have no natural allies. That is their weakness. Why are they trying to rip allies apart from us? Because they know that's our strength. So, but we have to put this in a new way for a new generation of leaders to also understand why allies are important. But they take a lot of work. They take a lot of patience. They take a lot of effort. But in the end, we have to believe that effort is worth it. I think we've diluted our own understanding of the effort and why it's important at the end of the day. And we have to remind ourselves of that. And I think Vice President Biden can do that, but I don't know whether he would have bandwidth and focus to be able to, in some ways, reinvent how Americans view allies in the future.
I want to get to that in a moment. I mean, just to round back on President Reagan, whatever the disagreements President Reagan may have had with German leadership at the time, and I remember the Pershing basing with Helmut Schmidt and all of that was something that was very tense, including conversations with François Mitterrand. But at no point was President Reagan ever provocative, negative, bombastic, or ever derided as somebody who was of the greatest generation. He never derided nor belittled Germany for any of the decisions it was taking, right? It was sort of a concerted, how do we engage and all get to someplace where we want to be, and actually enabled courageous decisions to be made by German leadership and brave the anti-war movement or the anti-nuclear movement in Germany to be able to say, hey, look, if we deploy these Pershing missiles, for example, on German soil, we will actually have a powerful deterrent capability, which ended up being the case against the SS-20s, as I recall.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. And again, I don't want to spend too much time on history, but it's so important to be grounded. Ronald Reagan understood how much American blood had been shed for the European project. So our investment is great. And when you visit the cemeteries, whether that's from World War I or World War II, the American cemeteries in Europe, that is what we honor. And that is what we work towards to make sure Europe remains stable, a bastion of prosperity and support for the United States. That's what we want. That's our great project and great legacy. But it requires tending. It requires nourishing. It requires a longer term strategic investment. And as I said, we have to relearn that. We just don't want to do it the painful way. But Ronald Reagan was also, and this is gets to our point of sort of the future, American leadership is also about pushing our European friends in places where they don't want to go. Right. And that's what takes a lot of energy. It is frustrating. I mean, Europeans are frustrated with Americans, and Americans are frustrated with Europeans, and that's the magic and mystery of the transatlantic relationship. But we have to push. We have to push constructively. We have to consult, and they will be with us. And right now, what I'm hearing from my European friends, as I'm sure you are too, getting lots of texts and messages and emails, they are pulling for us. They are pulling for us. They want America to be strong. They know our adversaries take advantage of the situation when we are weak and divided. So all our allies doing right now, they're worried, obviously lots of public comments to that worry and strain, but they need us to be strong, and we need to be strong as well.
If I recall, the Cayenne Memorial Museum in Normandy has, if I recall, sort of that the blood of American youth was spilled here so that future generations could live in peace, which I think is a very powerful statement. I may be getting it a little bit wrong, but my memory is a little bit rusty on it. Let me take you to the issue of bipartisan support for this project. Anytime a leader exhibits bad behavior, bad judgment, it has a tendency of infecting, as a bad apple would, the rest of the barrel, right? And I recall an event back when you could have events actually with people sitting across the table from you.
We miss those days.
We miss those days. And it actually involved food as well. I mean, it's just really quite extraordinary and no masks. But it was Republican and Democratic senior staffers. And it was a lamentation on the part of the Republican how the president is fundamentally changing sort of the international globalist view of the Republican Party. And then the Democrat was lamenting that that mindset is then corroding some Democrats who are reverting back to a protectionist, nationalist, buy American tendency of, hey, you know what, these foreigners should tend to themselves. It's time for us to nation build at home, right? It plays into that narrative. Are you seeing, as somebody who engages and tries to advance the project from your perch at CSIS, sort of a sectoral shift as, you know, as the leader of one party starts to reset the tone, and then that sort of starts to get to the other party that had a slightly different, right, that was far less internationalist, far less globalist, and much more protectionist in its posture? And in fact, right, I mean, we've had NDAA language to buy American on weapons in a way that would be actually, you know, thank goodness it was stopped by the chairman, but potentially a very, very negative development. Do you see a broader shift that's underway?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think there's some good news and there's some bad news here. So it's a very much mixed picture. And you're absolutely right. I mean, this is where CSIS is at the intersection of trying to make sure we have strong bipartisanship as we approach foreign and security policy. So what I've seen over the last 4 years when after President Trump's arrival in the White House, what I was actually detecting was more bipartisanship on Capitol Hill than we understood about foreign security policy, and very specifically around allies, because it was Congress's attempt of balance and ballast to the president's, you know, very untraditional views about allies. I also saw that in the Defense Department and intelligence community. The more that things got, you know, very raucous from the bilateral perspective and the leader to leader, boy, everyone just tried to dig deeper to balance it. So Congress was weighing in with sense of Congress and support for NATO. The Senate created the NATO and reconstituted a NATO observer group, which it hadn't done in a very long time. The military was just deepening their partnerships the best they could to create that balance. So what I saw was a revisiting of bipartisanship. And there is, if you sort of push away all the politics of it, and that's hard to do, there's bipartisanship on Turkey. There's bipartisanship, I would argue, on Russia. There's bipartisanship on China. There's a lot of things to start working with. I hope it can be nurtured, because again, if our national security is not on a bipartisan strong footing, we are not going to be successful, and our adversaries exploit those weaknesses. So all we're doing is giving our adversaries a whole lot of opportunity to weaken the United States. And I think anybody in a position of public service cannot allow that to happen. So hopefully we can get on some better footing. Hopefully we can get through this uncertain period as quickly as possible. But you're right, and this is the bad news, because the political center in our country has been hollowed and hollowing out, what you're seeing is the extreme wings for both the Republican and the Democratic Party. Those extreme wings are now bending together and they're meeting together on protectionism. So that's certainly in the trade dimension, as you mentioned. And you know, again, this sense of, and for me, the left more extreme element is, you know, we should not have any military forces anywhere overseas. We need to bring it home, you know, quite isolationist in that perspective. And then the extreme right also agrees we need to bring it home. And they're reducing US strength or reducing us. And so those arcs are coming together. And that is of great concern to me. And you're seeing that language in the NDAA, as you mentioned. But look, let's go back. Look at some of the most successful, large procurements. I'm thinking of the Joint Strike Fighter. That is conceptualized as an international effort that our allies can gain benefit. Of course, they have parliaments too, and it's their treasure as well. But we're working together. If we bring this all back and protect ourselves, we're going to lose at the end. Our allies are not going to increase their defense spending and create interoperability and now interchangeability. So we're force multiplying our defense capabilities. So we've got to fight these tendencies. We really do. And this is why the center has to come back in a much stronger way. But we have to justify to the American people why we're doing this. And that's what's been missing. You know, the American people, for understandable reasons, says, you know, we don't trust you guys anymore. You haven't had great success the last two decades. We have got to be able to explain this, show some success, but we have to place it in the context of this increases America's security and American prosperity. We are a self-interested actor, but our allies support that. So hopefully we can get to that justification.
But right, demagoguery is very hard to fight against with what is considered by many of us in this community sort of self-evident fact, right?
Yeah.
Because we have allies and partners, they buy something like the F-35. I mean, for some nations, that is the biggest military purchase they've ever made, which is an enormous vote of confidence in the alliance with the United States. And we benefit from that exchange of technology. Countless lives were saved, whether it was European medical or armor or other electronic warfare capabilities. And so that's, really baffling that some people who are expressing this may be veterans whose lives were actually saved by either allied troops or allied technology. And that's a little bit of the frustration there, is that, you know, this rhetoric makes the making of that case much, much harder. Go ahead.
Well, I was just saying, this is in some ways one of the accomplishments. Now, tactically, the how it was done, I'm not fully supportive of, but, you know, the U.S. has really increased foreign military sales to our allies in the last 3.5 years, and extraordinarily so. That is something we can build on that supports American jobs and American interests, but it supports this strong allied approach to meeting global challenges. That's the second part. It's been sold as sort of salesmanship in chief, but it is about, you know, it's sort of that old, is it a MasterCard commercial? You know, you can list all the prices of, the F-35 and that, but, you know, the relationship is the priceless part. There's not a price tag on that. And all that interoperability just makes that relationship even more priceless.
I think that some of that was driven by a sense of, you know, how do we curry favor? So that, I think, played into it. Some of these deals obviously had started in the Bush administration. You were in the State Department when some of these transactions started. As you know, they take decades sometimes to reach fruition. And then some of it was, oh my God, we can't rely on the United States. So let's just arm up in case we have to do. So, I mean, I think there were a variety of factors at play, even if the net result is positive and allies are spending a little bit more money. I've got to ask you one last question before we go, which is, does the administration's, what happens with the administration's snap and punitive decision to reduce America's troop presence in Germany, which took military commanders off guard. I mean, it took everybody off guard. Russia paid no, you know, Russia gave nothing up for us to make this unilateral decision and then push troops to places where actually training is much harder than it is in Germany. There's this sense that this is being slow rolled and studied. There's a sense that if Joe Biden becomes president, that this will be reversed. Does this get reversed? And if Donald Trump is reelected, how does that get stopped? Does Congress stop it? What happens? Because it's not abundantly clear to me that the president will have nearly the opposition. I mean, he didn't have any opposition really from a Republican Congress during his tenure in office. So I wouldn't imagine the second term would be any different.
Well, I mean, you're right. We don't know exactly the status of that. We know today that Congress has not budgeted the extraordinary sums that it would require to return over half of those forces back to the United States. And then it's unclear to me exactly where the other forces will be dispersed to within Europe. So there was just the question of who's paying for that. The facilities that the Pentagon announced where the U.S. forces would go to Mons and others aren't prepared to even host additional forces. So that would be an extraordinary expense. So it's just the practicalities of this. There's a reason that the military is studying this because A, they were told to do it. So it was not something that was generated by them. Right. And it's absolutely unclear to me where the money is. So you're right. I think if Vice President Biden is elected, that will be stopped. But I would imagine that there will and there should be some streamlining of headquarters. There should always be streamlining and greater efficiencies in headquarters. And there's also, you know, we need to have in Europe much more flexible, adaptable force rotation. That's what makes sense. But you're right, Germany is really the logistics linchpin of that. We have world-class facilities. The German government is a strong and reliable host. As I said, we need to, you know, streamline, get some cost savings, but it was a punitive measure. You're absolutely right. So I would suspect that would end. If President Trump is reelected, different story. I think the military will proceed. But again, I don't see Congress budgeting the billion, you know, whatever the estimate is, and I think it's in the billions, to do this. And so there may be another slow rolling from Congress. But it was to me surprising that Korea's force posture didn't change with an announcement during this administration. There is a strong view from the President Trump and his White House to really bring those troops back. And that is also, again, as we talked about in the protectionism phase, that would be fine by the progressive left. That would be fine too. So you do see those two arcs starting to bend together, not just on protectionism for trade, but also on troop presence.
Let me just go quickly before we leave, because this isn't a foregone conclusion how this will go. And you mentioned sort of the danger and the damage already done, and it's avoidable. If we have another 4 years of a Trump administration that does what it's been doing, does that then become irrevocable, the damage?
You're already beginning to see allies beginning rhetorically to do strategic decoupling from the United States. Again, very specifically from Europe. They've been sort of rhetorically trying to position themselves in strategic autonomy, technological autonomy. Right now it is more, it's rhetorical, it's not actual. But what we're seeing right now, and this is sort of in the backdrop of great power competition. And again, remember what this administration's national security strategy, national defense strategy, it, you know, says China and Russia are two near peer military competitors. And at the center of our strategy is an allied and partner-centric approach, that how we address our adversaries is through an allied-centric approach. So what was always so baffling is that this administration had attacked those very allies. But what this has done now is Europe in particular is now starting to say, in this dynamic of great power competition, Europe must be a separate pole, a separate core. So it cannot be under the influence of China or Russia or the United States. So it now sees separation from the US as its best strategic choice. And of course, that is a tremendous loss for the United States, which again, going back to our earlier comment, our allies are our unfair competitive advantage in the great power competition game. That's how we force multiply. So the fact that our allies, if President Trump is reelected, will now be going much more clearly in the place of, I am a separate entity. I don't think they'll be successful. I think that's a flawed strategic approach, but it's happening as an antibody to the Trump administration's adversarial approach at the most senior levels to our allies. And that's, again, as we talked about, as you look at the great American sacrifice for a strong Europe that works hand in glove with the United States, this is a strategic loss if that is what is going to come to pass.
Heather Connolly, thanks very, very much for joining us. It's always an honor and pleasure, and look forward to having you back on when we know one way or another, so we can queue up some issues on how a new administration should think about them. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.